Pleasure to be here, and special thanks to Ashwin for volunteering me here. I guess I see my task today as mainly to provide you with a smooth transition from the previous talk, maybe even adiabatic, to your lunch. Because of that, I'm going to talk about something which almost everyone can relate to. And it's probably going to be the simplest talk you have heard in this workshop so far. So I'm going to talk about thermal transport, and it's one of those experimental techniques which everyone has experience with, whether you're in Canada or England or even in California. And it's also an experiment everyone is entitled for an opinion on, and I'll provide you with mine. Apologies to those people in the audience who have seen this talk in the other circumstances. I didn't have much new to insert there. Okay, so this is the work with Christian Batista and a number of former postdocs and students who helped a little bit here and there. And the main contribution from experimental side is due to Alex Olubenko. So he provided us his fantastic thermal conductivity data. Unfortunately, Alex actually had to quit physics, but he left quite significant heritage, and people are still going through it. So this has been published at least partially, which I'm going to talk about. And as a backdrop, which I'm not going to say any more words about it, is that this recent, or reasonably recent experiments in organics have demonstrated that thermal conductivity is an experimental technique and can serve as sort of a smoking gun experiment. And my story is different, though. It's about the BEC systems, and they became almost famous about 10, maybe 13, 14 years ago. And the real hero was for quite some time was this material which is called Han Purple. And I'm actually showing here it has a long history. It's probably one of the earliest man-made MOT insulators. And out of this, so it has been used as a pigment in more than 2,000 years ago. And if you go through this list, it's actually one of it's the only one which is man-made. Everything else is from minerals. So it's representative of a kind of stereotypical BEC system, which most of which are a bunch of dimers, put on some lattice in some sort of filing. Okay? And these dimers are formed by copper spins, therefore with anti-ferromagnetic coupling you have singlets, and then you have a very simple kind of local Hilbert space which you then can weakly couple, and you have a distortion, and then if you apply magnetic fields you have you demon split the triplet, and at some point you have a condensation, and that's sort of the essence of the BEC name. And it provides you with a very simple phase diagram for all these systems. The state above the upper critical field is a fully polarized spin state, which is classical. So there are no quantum fluctuations there, but there are some fluctuations here below HC1. You have a paramagnetic state, but the BEC state itself, in terms of magnetic order, is just the Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet in external field. So you have still have U1 symmetry, which is spontaneously broken, and that's why it's called BEC. This is a small but reasonably significant subset of such materials studied at Los Alamos. So again, this is barium copper silicate. This was the hero. And the hero of my talk is the material which has an unpronounceable name, dichlorated trappist thorium nickel. And we call it DTN for short. Its advantage over other BEC systems is actually twofold. First of all, you notice that the HC2 here is rather small, and it's actually prohibitively large for most of other BEC magnets, for most of experimental technique. Here you can access both HT1 and HT2. And the second advantage is that it's actually very thin. It's one of those materials which is grown from some water solution of stuff or something. Okay. All right, so it actually also has some history. It was known to chemists for some time. Then 2004, Los Alamos people picked it up, and then there was some flood of experimental papers. This is our paper. Okay, so you may wonder, why is it sort of the same? Why is it, it's based on nickel, okay? So it's been one system. Actually, the largest parameter in the model is the single ion anisotropy, which is positive, and it's large. It's the largest parameter in the model. So you have, your full rotational symmetry is broken. In fact, what this term forces you to have, it forces you to have S is equal to zero on each side. Okay, it's non-magnetic state, but then what happens is that when you apply magnetic field, if you apply it along the strong axis, which is also the axis of not coincidentally the axis of the of the lattice here, if you apply magnetic field in the same direction, actually crystals want to be oriented. They want to be reoriented along the same axis somehow. At least that's what I was told. And what happens there is that instead of splitting the trick, if you split Sz plus 1 and Sz minus 1 excited states, the doublet, and then the condensation goes the same way as in the dimer-based materials. Okay? So it's the same phase diagram you have there. And the mapping is essentially the same. Okay, let me mention previous attempts to study thermal conductivity in the other BEC systems, and thallium copper chloride is another is actually one of the it's probably the first material from which the whole saga has began, and this is how its spectrum looks like, triplet being split by magnetic field looks like. But this is the behavior of thermal conductivity as a function of the field, and you can see that what it contains essentially is this picture. It's a decrease of phonon thermal current by bringing down magnetic excitations due to closing of the gap, and then some recovery of the same phonon current because you move away some other magnetic states. You move it away from phonon population. Sort of similar, but maybe more complicated story in the other paper by Sologubenko on leather material, and there are two more examples of which I can speak. All of them observe only phonon thermal transport, nothing coming from magnetic systems, which is sort of disappointing, and it's maybe a little bit puzzling, but in some cases it can probably be improved. The conditions, experimental conditions, can be improved, and something can be observed, should be observed. Okay, the happy story is the story of the DTM. Before I show you experimental data, I'll also show another set of experimental data from neutron scattering in zero field. So this is distortion of that excited doublet. And one number to remember from it is that the gap here in zero field is 3 Kelvin. Okay, there is some anisotropy because J is anisotropic. It's a factor of 5 anisotropic here. Okay, there were some preliminary data which were published before, after Alex already obtained his data, but before some portion of his data were published because, well, he was leaving physics. So at some point I got this data via Los Alamos group, and it just fascinated me on pure aesthetical level. Complicated features shown here. So this is a field that is thermal conductivity normalized in certain ways. So I started working on that, and some initial ideas actually never worked. let's try to see what's shown here first. Let me explain to you why it's shown in this way, and let's also see what are the features here which can be puzzling. So it's not an unquestionable way of representing data. It's what's shown here is the thermal conductivity as a function of the field normalized to its zero field value for different temperatures. So this normalization, what it achieves Because normally, at least at low temperatures, what thermal conductivity does, it goes down as some power law. So this normalization allows you to sort of bring all these sets of data on the same scale. Okay. That's probably the main reason. Well, another thing is that if you are at 0.3 Kelvin, and as I said, it's the gap is 3 Kelvin, you're pretty sure that what goes in the denominator here in this case is just phonons. So everything above 1 then must be coming from elsewhere. Okay? So it's sort of also an additional proof that you have current from magnetic excitations. And I showed you previous data which were unsuccessful. You only saw the negative, you only saw reduction of thermal conductivity. There is more to this, slightly more to this picture than, you know, you see signs of critical fields. You also see suppression. Once you enter the ordered phase, which is here between the two critical fields, you see that the total thermal conductivity retains some of the features, some of these interesting wiggles, which are certainly coming from magnetic excitations. Not the phonons are pretty uniform. It can be checked independently by studying some other directions for thermal conductivity. But basically, you see that the overall thermal conductivity is suppressed. What happens is, of course, phonons get scattered on gapless magnetic excitations, and this eats up some of the thermal current. Okay? And one has to account for that, and there are ways of accounting for that, at least semi-quantitatively. And I'm not going to speak about that, but if you ask me, I can show you the procedure. Okay, so the actual study we have performed in that paper I mentioned was mostly concerning these 2 points. Another pointer. So the question was about the difference or the lack of difference between the height of these 2 points, and I'm going to say a few words about that, and then if time permits, I will also say a few words about the outside of the paramagnetic phase, and also one more word about the behavior inside the ordered phase. Okay, so we call it a Nova symmetry problem. So if you go to specific heat, which is a sort of complementary quantity to the thermal conductivity, and you just go through the textbook analysis of the density of states, you have a gap state in the paramagnetic phase, you have in 3D just you know, linear excitations, phonon-like excitations in the ordered state, and then at the critical point you have parabolic mode. So you estimate what specific it should be. It should be exponential, t cubed. In the order that when you have a parabola, you have t to the 3 halves. Okay, it's the mean field result. And it actually matches rather remarkably well what is observed in experiment. It is the only exception that the height at HC2 is about six times higher than at HC1. Okay. And it's, you know, there's two related quantities, and you don't observe this. It's not a factor of 10, but it's sort of, it's almost the square root of the order of magnitude of the active image, okay? Not the order of magnitude, but still significant. And it's actually, you know, you look at some other measurements, they have done quite a few different measurements, and anomaly of HC2 is always larger than at HC1. Not in thermal conductivity. So that's the question, and the first step is to understand why it's a symmetric in PCTQ. And the first realization is that, of course, it's not just temperature, but there is an energy scale to which you need to relate, so sort of kinetic energy. And so the mass should enter here. So specific heat at these 2 points should scale as 3/2 of mass as well. And there is qualitative argument why it should be the masses should be different in these two critical fields. The upper critical field is just, as I said, it's fully polarized state, so nothing happens there. It's just bare. You can consider this bare, unrenormalized particle. And for the HC1 and below, your mass is kind of is undressing, and it's basically these fluctuations around your excitation. They allow you to propagate freer, and then it's it sort of reduces your mass. And can be put in a more formal ground by introducing sort of Schrödinger boson representation for all three spin components, and then solving it, condensing the z equal to zero boson, and introducing some mean fields condensation S square, and then treating the rest of the Hamiltonian and again in the self-consistent mean field way. So you diagonalize it with standard Bogoliubov transformation. What you end up with is a self-consistent equation on the condensation fraction of zeros and chemical potential. So this can be actually solved quite efficiently. Then you have masses and this some approximation, the resulting ratio of masses at two critical fields, at upper critical field, the lower critical field, is essentially when HC2 is much larger than HC1, which is our case, the ratio of masses is roughly speaking the same ratio of the fields one half. Okay? So in some other technical terms, you can actually relate masses to certain coherence factors if I'm allowed to borrow terminology from superconductivity terminology. So this mass anisotropy is quite significant, 3.2 for this set of parameters. And actually, this set of parameters are fitting very nicely, not only the HC1 value and HC2 value, which allow you to fix two out of three parameters, but also the whole dispersion, which is known from neutron scattering. So it's actually quite accurate description of most of the quantities, and actually some other quantities that fit extremely well. It's just these numbers. So we know we believe this is actually correct to a number to that significant figure, and. Then you 3/2 this, and you get the coefficient 5.7, which almost magically there is certain level of coincidence here, but you want to believe that this is just how excellent your theory is. Okay, but it's probably somewhat of a coincidence, of course. Okay, but it does explain the asymmetry for the specific here. Okay, so of course. Thermoconductivity contains more than just specific heat. It has mean free pass and stuff. And for the parabolic distortion, so inside the ordered phase, you can say, well, you know, point-like impurities are irrelevant here. You don't. It's a relay scattering too weak. So in the case of parabolic distortion, it's not. You have to include it, and it's a textbook, essentially textbook answer for the mean free pass due to point-like impurities. So. Another piece of small piece of algebra, you just take these two points and say, okay, what's the ratio of thermoconductivities if I have impurities as a scattering mechanism? Well, it's the ratio of masses and the ratio of mean free passes. Okay. There are several attempts to bypass all kinds of calculation. I just jump to the conclusion. And the most natural attempt to bypass any calculation fails, because you say, okay, M is inverse kinetic energy, and it's renormalized by fluctuations. But impurity potential, where is it coming from? Well, it's coming from local distortions, and local distortions renormalize your J's, and J's are kinetic energy. Okay, so and basically, two kinetic energy and inverse kinetic energy renormalization must cancel, and therefore mean free passes should be the same. So the observed picture must be looking more like this. Okay, and it gave us some headache. For a while, but then we realized that there is a difference. There are actually different type of disorders. So there are bond disorders. Basically, the answer is the following. So there is bond disorder and there is site disorder. Okay, and site disorder is favorable from two perspectives. First of all, I mentioned in the beginning that D is the largest parameter in your model. So it's if you start playing with local variations of couplings. You change few percent J, you change few percent D. Of course, the largest number change percentage-wise will also be the largest perturbation. So delta D must be more important than delta J. Okay, so this is what I call chemistry or material science consideration. It's also, another consideration is that actually this material is very clean, therefore strong strong impurities are unlikely, like removal, you know, or very rare, so missing site or something like that. Okay, so by this logic, you select delta D, but you still need to do some calculations. And if you do these calculations, actually, you find that if you've done all the strong and weak and intermediate sort of exact T matrix calculations. So you can argue that strong coupling case actually leads to the same conclusion as before the equal mean free pass, because whatever is left in your randomized, when you go to unitary limit, whatever is left there is the kinetic energy. Okay, whether it's coming from delta D or delta G, if you send both to infinity, you should go to this team. Okay, so the only exception is this one, and again, it basically gives you different combination of coherence factors, and well, they translate to this expression, which is not too informative for you. But if I rewrite it through mass ratio, it at least starts telling you something. Instead of translating this into the ratio of magnetic fields, which will kind of make it a little bit more cumbersome, I'll better plot ratio of thermal conductivities versus ratio of critical fields. So what I do, I start playing with this phase diagram. I say, well, what if I just start applying pressure or negative pressure, changing J's, right? And I move HC1 versus HC2 around. So when they coincide, you have one point of condensation. Of course, in this case, masses are equal, and therefore the ratio should be 1, it's 1, okay? So it's not a perfect constellation. There is no perfect constellation here. However, it gives you this interesting nonlinear function, which dives slightly below 1, and then it does go up. But it goes up at very small ratio of HC1. So HC1 has to be 1/10 or less than HC2. Okay, so DTN again happened to be here. The ratio is 1.1, and again, it's probably, you know, this 10% accuracy must be coincidence of some sort, but it's still kind of pleasant to see. All right, for comparison, this is the ratio of specific hits, and you can see that it shows qualitatively different behavior, just monotonic, and again, the ratio here is quite significant. Okay, so this is conclusion for this part of the talk, and the question is, okay, it's interesting, you explained DTN, why is it relevant to other BEC methods? Because other BEC methods don't even know what single ion anisotropy is, right? There's no, you know, copper, those which are based on dimers, they don't have single ion anisotropy. And the logic there is actually the following. So what you have J and delta J. And the one which is responsible for kinetic energy, so you start playing with the lattice distortions and you start modifying J's and delta J. Of course, the most important modification will be intra-dimer coupling. Okay? And the point is that kinetic energy is not coming from J. Kinetic energy is coming from J prime. It's coming from the weak coupling between dimers. So modification of J is a modification of the chemical potential. So the dimer in this mapping to bosons for the dimer-based material is actually, you have one boson per dimer. Okay? So J translates into chemical potential variation of J will have the same scattering as delta D. So this whole curve is applicable, we believe, to the whole class of BC magnets. And of course, we welcome any criticism as well as more experiments on the dimer-based systems. Okay, so there are some other suggestions on about DTN to apply pressure, but since there's the next generation of Alex's campus is not grown up yet, in Cologne they are trying to catch up on his previous achievements, but they have not repeated his experiments yet. Okay, all right. So this is kind of the published part, and the rest of it will be some considerations with varying degree of accuracy. Let's put it this way. So let me show you how the distortions gets modified by the field. This is how densities of states get modified by the field. And the point is that for for the thermal conductivity, it's actually not the density of states, but density of states v squared, which matters, right? Because you're dealing with currents. And actually, this means that once you have a minima, or you have a linear dispersion, this effective, what I call dos v square, is actually not that different. Okay? The point is that in the ordered phase, and here, especially you just move away from the parabola, okay? You haven't modified it much yet. Difference in this quantity is not that significant. And tau, you don't expect it to be, you know, changing too much, but nevertheless, there are minima. There are significant minima in the thermoconductivity right away after you enter the ordered phase. So this suggests some strongly field-dependent scattering, which occurs only inside the ordered phase, but only for the period, for the range of the field. So there is some recovery late. So this is the question, why do we have minima? The second question, which will go first, is what we call peak migration problem. So if you take a phase diagram and check what HC1 and HC2 are for finite temperatures and just put them on the experimental data, you can see that the peak, the maximum in thermoconductivity actually goes away from the line of transition. And thinking of line of transition as where the, you know, your temperature, what temperature does with the minima, with the minimum of the dispersion, it provides a blue shift. Okay, so it shifts it up. So mean fieldish understanding of the line of transition is where the you actually apply more field to actually close down this gap. Okay. So this is the true line of transitions, and this is where the maximum thermoconductivity are. So we call it migration of the peaks. So the gap, the delta gap, this extra field which needs to be applied is the gap in the boson spectrum. Okay, so as you raise temperature, of course, the next available scattering you may think about, in addition to impurities, is the boson scattering on themselves. And I discussed impurities already quite extensively. What I want to add to it is that it doesn't care about what the gap is. It cares about the velocity, but it doesn't care what the gap is. Okay. On the other hand, what impurity, just making long story short, it's impurity scattering, it has some temperature prefactor, but the essential part of it is it contains the gap. Basically, boson scattering, bosons which are thermally excited, and you have if you have a gap, you have to have an exponent there. Okay, so if you combine these two now and just plug it into a simplistic Boltzmann equation and just try to simulate it. So this is kappa over T square, and the leading power law for the impurity scattering. The vertical line here is the line of transition, again defined the way I just described. And this is the thermoconductivity by T square. So I increase temperature, and this is only for when impurity scattering is included. Okay, so you see nothing. You see just broadening of the wings of these peaks. Nothing happens on this side of the phase diagram. If you start including boson scattering, you see appearance of the maximum. So you see this migration. Now it's kind of okay. So the physical question: what's going on here? And the answer is the short answer is that there is an idea of a Goldilocks gap. So you bring down, when you close down the gap, you bring heat carriers, but you also bring scatterers. And there is an optimum. So there is an optimal condition where you have just enough heat carriers and not too many scatterers. Okay? So this effect should be stronger, this migration should be stronger for heavier particles than based on density of states arguments. So at HC2, which is a heavier particle, case, you should expect this migration stronger. Okay. Another a complementary way, but not fully parallel, is to justify this picture is actually is the following. So you can say that this optimal gap is where impurity scattering mean free pass and boson scattering mean free pass are the same, and just making very crude. Rather crude approximation that all the coupling constants are the same. It basically translates to the statement that the number of bosons is equal to number of impurities. But then again, one of the scattering mechanisms depart, so you solve it as the gap versus t, and it actually results into this somewhat unusual function t log t, and which has a negative part which I'm not showing, which essentially tells you that for range of temperatures, mean free pass due to boson-boson scattering never reaches the impurity mean free pass, but then it starts, it sort of exceeds it, and then this will be the position of the optimal gap. And then what you do, you just take the experimental data and measure the shift of the peak and put it on the graph and try to fit it with this function, and actually this function does a fantastic job for the HC2 and sort of okay fit for HC1. Again, the effect for HC2 is much more pronounced. Okay, so we claim that this is sort of solution. Okay, all right. Last but not the least is almost on time. Is this puzzle of minima, and it actually touches upon something which I've had some interest in for quite some time. So basically the idea is the following. So first of all, you don't go from parabola to the straight line right away. So you go through the concave spectrum. Some semantics here. Depends on which way you are sitting. You can define it as concave or convex. But it sort of goes back to the Belyaev spectrum a long time ago. But you have this spectrum for a while, for some window of the field. Second thing is that, again, the Wodrick phase is nothing. It's not just an antiferromagnet. It's a canted antiferromagnet. Okay, spins are canted. And this second point actually results into the presence always inside this phase diagram. You have three boson coupling. So you can take one with the proper conditions, with the proper kinematic conditions, with the proper form of the spectrum, which allows you the two particle continuum to be below the single particle range. You can take one particle and split it in two. Okay. All right. So you have decays, you have additional scattering channel for your heat carriers. And again, this is very sort of qualitative. This is the actual simulation of 1/tau for not quite DTN, but for a related problem. You can see that 1/tau actually leans towards the HC. And this is 1/tau, and you presume that your tau contributes to, not 1/tau, contributes to your depletion of your thermal current, and that seems to be at least again kind of in the framework of hand waving argument. It's actually a good hand waving argument that this is this must be the case here. Okay, so those are my conclusions. This is DTN provided us with the first unquestionable field-induced thermal current by spin excitations in DEC systems, and there are certain set of puzzles we have addressed. There are some which have not been addressed, and actually, if there would be more experiments or more people in working on this experimentally, that would be of tremendous help. Thank you.
So I have a question about the critical point. This is a case where you understand the critical point pretty well. And so there's some prediction for what the temperature dependence of thermal conductivity would be there. It seems like it's the same as the phonons. Mm-hmm. The peaks are sort of lining up at low temperatures. Is that what you expect? Or?
Can you repeat this question?
Let's go to your conclusion slide.
I can show you better data. So okay, here. Uh-huh.
So at low temperatures, all these things are lining up.
Yeah.
There's no temperature dependence. The temperature depends is the same as phonons, right?
No. No. So this is close to 3, T to the 3, 2.7 actually, because of some specular reflection. Now, the pure phonon is TQ.
But experimentally, what I observe for phonons is the same as what you observe over here with the temperature dependence.
The temperature dependence of magnetic part is T squared. at least the prediction is such, and it seems to seems to work fine.
Except perhaps at the lowest temperatures, right?
No. Let me. Oops. Yeah, so this is the Fonon part on kappa over t versus t. So this is not parabola, this is t to the, actually t to the power 1.7, which, you know, so it's Fonon is not t cubed precisely. And I don't know if you can see this color. So this is t squared slope. Okay. So this contains both Fonon contribution and magnetic contribution. This is at 2 tesla and 12 tesla. So it's certainly different from there.
Questions?
Just curious, in this material, you can introduce zinc impurity in a controlled way to check the impurity.
No, you haven't tried. No, it's.
That would be a nice way to check your.
Yeah, well, it will certainly kill all conductivity very quickly, so you have to be really precise. This high control. I'm not sure. Again, this is one of those organic materials which grow from water, and zinc is the proper choice for nickel in this case, but lots of things should be tried.
So presumably if you put the feed away from the c-axis, there's no transition,
Well, there is still a critical point, right? At
crossover or something.
Well, at the point there is a point, but then there is no, the phase diagram is a crossover. So you would still see something of some peak at the critical field. So I'm not sure what you're going to see in because you're going to get gap. Going to get the gap phase instead of the older phase. So they are, well.
But there is some conductivity data?
Not in the, well, okay, so there is, no. There is actually very, there are data for thermal conductivity in the perpendicular direction in the same field, right? Which is not what you're asking, but tilting field comes out is crushes the material, so the torque is such that it starts breaking apart. Yeah.
Probably you explained, but I can't miss it. So why Poulon is T? Why Poulon is not T cubed?
This is an old story. It's basically you have a great surface. It's never perfect. Okay, so there are still some imperfections. And if so, basically, T cube is just a boundary scattering. It's a density of space. You know, we created all the points that all go from boundary to boundary and die there. Okay. But if you have surfaces of which you reflect, and basically, it's an assumption that the scattering of points doesn't depend on the wavelengths. And of course, it does once you start having a little bit of reality there. The shorter wavelength quantum sees roughness while the longer one does not. So you have the proof that it should be 2.7 doesn't exist. It's actually it's a curious old problem. Nobody knows why it's so small correction. It's a great question because this is the way you prove that your crystal is of high quality. It has to violate from the theory. In fact, very few materials, very few real hard materials. It has to be clean. Very very few materials show TQ to begin with. I mean, diamond does. Some perfect crystals do, but if you try to do it on parental high TC, you don't see TQ. You have dislocations. You have other mechanisms.
Okay, so maybe let's call it lunch.